The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Fred Brack reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 10 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And I do apologize, but it would seem that our control board here is missing the left channel of our recorded music that I introduced the show with, and will come up again at the end, so it probably sounded very low to you. Nothing I can do about that right now except just keep on reading. And I am going to be reading from the March 2022 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. The theme is Blowing Rock this month, How a Landmark Became a Legend. And we're going to start with an article about the Sand Hill Women's Exchange, which was founded in 1922. It's written by Susan Stafford Kelly. The founding history of Pinehurst is both charming and not a little startling. In 1895, James Tufts, a Boston soda fountain magnate, purchased 5,800 acres in Moore County. Timberland so ravaged for tar and turpentine that little was left but sand and stumps to create a health retreat. Golf officially arrived in the person of famed course designer Donald Ross in 1900. Wealthy East Coasters flocked. Imagine, then, the contrast mere miles away from the links and fairways, the elegant hotel and the gala evenings, to country families living down dirt roads in near-poverty conditions, lacking indoor plumbing, telephones, or transportation, and, most important, with farm women bound at home by children, having no outlet to earn money and no way of reaching it, even if they did. Widows, too, who lost their husband's income, were prevented by societal mores from seeking employment. This was the Carolina Desert, reminds Audrey Moriarty, executive director of the Given Memorial Library and the Tufts Archives. There were no stores, a board member of the Sand Hill Women's Exchange, or SWE, adds. It was a golf place, a resort. Plus, this was a seasonal community until air conditioning came along in the 1960s. The season shut down in May when the heat drove everyone back north. Yet, affluent visitors to the village of Pinehurst had seen the skills of country women at the 1922 Sand Hills Fair, baked and canned goods, quilts and rugs, baby clothes. Another Boston native, Catherine Tuckerman, was familiar with the Federation of Women's Exchanges, a national organization whose motto was and is helping others to help themselves. Quite radical, considering its founding date of 1832. These exchanges provided women with a location to sell their homemade goods. In May 1923, Tuckerman, Molly Lovering, Dorothea Crocker Cowgill, and seven other women met to formally organize recruit funds and search for a location to establish the Sand Hill Women's Exchange. That location is as much a part of Pinehurst history as the exchange itself. In the early 1800s, a one-room cabin was built adjacent to a grist mill northeast of town. After the Civil War, it was moved to the Archibald Mackenzie family home to serve as a kitchen. Pinehurst founder Tufts was so taken with the cabin that the Mackenzies gave it to him, and he relocated it to the village in 1896 to serve as a museum for early Sand Hills artifacts. The Tufts family donated the cabin to the exchange in 1924. 200 years later, that chinked and hand-hewn cabin, Pinehurst's oldest structure, still stands and serves as the Sand Hill Women's Exchange, celebrating its own centennial this year. Members Sandy Gernhardt and Susan Taylor Schran have devoted years to researching the SWE's history. In the Tufts archives of Given Memorial Library, the earliest meetings of the SWE are collected in the original folder tied with twine. The pages, speckled and discolored with age, bear the handwritten notes that detail what the exchange meant to the women who were supplementing agrarian incomes. One officer discovered a woman who made placemats and rugs on a loom that was likely from the Civil War era. Local farmers cured hams, and members of the exchange sold and shipped them. They gathered and sold kindling for Raleigh hearths. Another note in the book that a Mrs. Philbrook sold 400 pounds of fudge in 1938. The exchange was a godsend to the women of the area, Taylor Schwann says. Think of it, what it meant in the Depression-era 1930s for a woman to earn an extra $200 a month or $1,000 a year. Think of what it means even now when a visitor reveals that without the exchange, we wouldn't have made it. The income from his mother's boiled peanuts put him through college. These organizers didn't merely provide a place to sell goods, though. They traveled to the poorer women's homes by car to transport their crafts along the ruts and shifting sands of Sand Hills roads. They taught the women newer, safer canning methods, more intricate needlework techniques, and other crafts. A 1920s article from the Pilot newspaper states that everything from doilies to cornhusk dolls to bedspreads was available for sale. What surprised these historians, never mind stymied their research, was that as late as 1975, SWE officers and members were listed by their husbands' names only. But what a joy when pleas for information sent out via social media produced a call and documents from Dorothea Crocker Cowgill's daughter, Meriwether Cowgill Schmidt, now 94 and living in Connecticut, who visited the exchange every spring break. "I've been coming here since I was yay high," exclaimed some visitors who hail from every state and overseas. Today, baby clothing, jewelry, foodstuffs, woodwork, and pottery from 32 artisans are displayed at the exchange. The artists who sell their works to the SWE do so to support its mission and to earn additional income for themselves. The current women behind the exchange, all volunteers, are still as devoted and persevering as Cowgill, whose poignant 1928 recollection paints an accurate, if heartbreaking, picture. Imagine living 17 miles from the tiniest town, caring for two cows, 4 to 8 children, and the yearly budget, depending on whether the tobacco and cotton crops were good or poor, and suddenly finding that by spending a few hours a week hooking rugs out of threadbare garments or knitting cotton gloves for the more fortunate who hunted to hounds, that you could have an extra $5 to $200 a month to spend on luxuries. It would be hard for us to really conceive the joy it brings. A doll for a child, a set of china plates, a bolt of fabric for a dress. Hard to conceive indeed when a multi-million-dollar resort is quite literally in a tennis court fence a mere arm's reach from the back door of the Sand Hill Women's Exchange. Within a grove of pines, the 200-year-old cabin, like the 100-year-old mission behind it, still stands, sturdy, humble, plucky, and permanent. Like it seems, the women who founded it and those long-gone souls who first sewed and knitted, loomed and hooked, cured and canned the products and handcrafts that made a difference not only in their daily lives, but in the history of North Carolina women. The Sand Hill Women's Exchange is located at 15 Azalea Road in Pinehurst. Their website is sandhillswe.org. An ad on the next page is for Wilkes Community College's Merle Fest, running April 28th to May 1st this year. Says tickets are on sale now, but they don't tell you how to get them. Sorry, can't help you there. Have to look it up on the web, I guess. And now, the family that cooks together, a family with ties to multiple Latin American countries, gathers to break bread. The matriarch prepares the food. Her son-in-law pulls together all of the disparate elements into a Charlotte restaurant dynasty, written by Kathleen Purvis. under a pavilion a few steps from Telma Moran Juarez's house in Charlotte suburbs is an outdoor kitchen set up just like her mother's back in El Salvador. Two brick fire pits for burning logs into coals, a waist-high wooden table with a fireproof concrete rectangle set in the middle, cement blocks that she arranges in U-shaped corrals to hold burning wood and hot coals, and battered racks on top that are easy to pull into place or drag out of the way. She doesn't just cook over the fire, she cooks in the fire, around the fire, and near the fire. She even makes coffee there using an earthen jug that belonged to her mother. Moving chunks of simmering pork belly from one pot to another, judging temperature and time by instinct and experience, Telma seems impervious to the white smoke that billows around her head. Her eyes don't even seem teary. She knows the right amount of fire, says her youngest daughter, Miriam Espalat. It is not a stove you can turn down. Miriam's husband is Dalton Espaillat, whose Radal Hospitality Group has quickly become known for its popular Latin American restaurant chains in Charlotte. It consists of 23 locations of Sabre Latin Street Grill, Three Amigos, and La Caseta, mother-made Latin food, including a spot inside the Bank of America Stadium. At La Caseta, the menu is organized by the countries where the family has ties. Tacos, Mexico, pupusas, I hope I pronounced that right, from El Salvador, arepas from Venezuela, and empanadas from Argentina. When the first La Caseta opened in June 2020 in Camp North End, Telma trained all the employees in the correct techniques for making pupusas. Dalton is Dominican. His versions of some of the dishes are a little different from those of his wife's family. By celebrating the food of this extended clan with all its regional variations, has always been part of his restaurants, starting with Sabor. In the beginning, Dalton says he would often charge less for dishes that were less familiar, just to get people to try things beyond tacos and burritos. Getting the chance to eat his mother-in-law's real dear Salvadorian food is always a treat. 20 years ago, nobody in Charlotte knew what an empanada was, what a pupusa was, he says. I had to teach them how to say it, and then I had to southernize it. Telma shares her house near Huntersville with her husband, Jose Guillermo Moran, known by the grandkids as Papi Mimo. Mimo is the nickname for Guillermo in El Salvador. The home is constantly filled with his sprawling family. Three daughters, a son, and their spouses, a close-knit pack of 10 grandchildren, and assorted aunts, uncles, and friends. Their family ties crisscross Latin America, not to mention the United States. Preparing big feasts isn't just about being a family that cooks together. This family crossed borders and decades to end up together in the Charlotte area. We were born into extreme poverty, Miriam says. When the children, Ruth, Anna, Renee, and Miriam, were young, Jose and Telma left them with Jose's mother in her village and fled El Salvador around 1983, coming to the U.S. undocumented in a desperate bid for a better life. They wouldn't see their children again for 6 years. At the time, El Salvador was in the middle of a civil war that stretched from 1979 to 1992, as the military-led government fought with the Farabundo Martí National Liberation Front. It was a brutal period of scorched earth campaigns, repressive policies, and retribution. In the U.S., the Morans took whatever jobs they could get, with Telma working as a nanny in New York City. They were singularly focused on reuniting the family. Telma's sister, Emelina Paredes, studied to be a nun and then requested a post in the United States so that she could help her sister and brother-in-law get the children here. The family eventually settled in Queens, and they were finally able to reunite with their children around 1991. By then, Miriam was 7 and hadn't seen her mother since she was 18 months old. At first, she says, she refused to believe that Telma was her mom. Miriam has struggled to make peace with that, she admits, although they are all very close today. In 1997, Telma opened a pupusa shop in the Flushing neighborhood of Queens, and all of the kids worked there as teenagers. She still owns the shop, frequently traveling back and forth between North Carolina and Charlotte, where her children have all settled. About 5 years ago, she and Jose decided to put down roots in Charlotte also. They didn't even see their house before they moved. They entrusted their grown children to pick one for them. It's in a rural subdivision with plenty of yard for Jose's gardening. They've now bought the house on either side to rent out, gaining even more land. The menu for the Saturday lunch at Telma and Jose's home is very traditional. Pupusas, little cornmeal cakes filled with ground chicharron, refried beans, and cheese. They're served with roasted tomato salsa and curtido, a refreshing cabbage slaw, and a fresh pineapple aqua fresca. To make aqua fresca, Telma eschews her daughter's preference for a blender that makes the beverage too smooth, she says. Instead of cutting away the tough rind and the dark eyes of the pineapple, she cuts it in half and then patiently uses a blunt knife to chop down into the yellow fruit inside. She works around the hard core in the center until she's left with two empty hulls and the two halves of the core. Mixed with cold water and sugar, the juicy pineapple pulp makes a rich, cold drink that everyone sips from small plastic cups. For dessert, Telma steps inside to make a Salvadorian quesadilla. They're not the cheese-filled tortillas that Americans know. They're fluffier cakes, similar to pound cake, made from rice flour and soft, fresh cheese, with sesame seeds sprinkled on top. She makes them small, about the size of your palm, using tin molds that she brought from El Salvador. She's been working for 2 days on this lunch, first cooking the small red beans that Salvadorans call frijol rojo de seda, or red silk beans, over the fire. The next day, she pureed them in a blender and fried them into pork fat over the fire. For the pupusa filling, she started at 10 a.m., simmering chunks of pork belly and tossing them into a second pot with a little fat to make crispy chicharrones. When the meat is ready, Jose and Renee clamp a grinder onto a work table and grind the chicharron into a big pan where it gets mixed with refried red beans, a few plum tomatoes, and fresh cheese. To make a pupusa is 5 minutes, but let me rephrase this because there's some emphasis in this sentence. To make a pupusa is 5 minutes, but to make it is 5 hours, Miriam explains, checking for her mother's approval as she chops cabbage for curtido, meaning it's all about the prep. Those last 5 minutes finally come at 2 p.m., and everyone starts to rush around. Jose shovels fresh coals onto the cooktop while Telma and Emelina take the dough made from corn flour and water and pat it into small rounds. They work it so quickly that it looks like a child's game of patty cake. They place a little filling in the center, fold the dough over, and pat it out again to form a round, flat pancake. Then they dip their fingers in oil to coat the outsides before placing each cake on a hot griddle over the fire. Rather than pour the oil straight onto the griddle, Telma prefers to oil the cakes directly so that they stay soft as they brown. Her daughters step in to help, cooking 4 pupusas at a time and using a spatula to turn them. Telma doesn't bother with the spatula. She just uses her fingers to lift the edge and check for browning. And then she flips the pupusas with her hand, not even seeming to notice the heat. The kids crowd around the work table, placing banana leaf squares on paper plates to contain any dripping fat, then topping the pupusas with slaw and salsa. Once the children are fed, the adults dive in, fixing plates to their liking and standing around to talk and catch up. Inside the house over the dining room table is a painting of Telma's outdoor kitchen in El Salvador, remarkably like the kitchen outside. You can even spot the earthen coffee jug that Telma still uses. As her extended family mills around outside, tucking into pupusas and all the condiments, Telma still hasn't picked up a plate herself. She just stands quietly, smiling by the fire, watching as her two worlds, her two kitchens, and her great big family all come together, united by food. And now, the inn place to stay. That would be I-N-N, of course. At the Route 19 Inn in Maggie Valley, generations of travelers fondly recall the forest and streams, shuffleboard and color scheme. Today it's a restored motel where new memories are being made. Land of Oz, ghost town in the sky. Tweetsie, Maggie Valley, Cherokee, grandfather, the Smokies. For a kid in the 70s, growing up at the foot of the mountains, these high country names conjured dreams of witches, spooky trains, phantom cowboys, crags transfigured into the face of a giant. When my family and I journeyed west from Taylorsville to visit some of these tourist attractions, enchantment veiled the kitsch. Now I'm 54, and nostalgia supplanted wonder. But I've learned that longing for something that's in the past isn't simply loss. It's also knowledge. Just like you don't really understand a coat until you're on a chilly peak without one, you don't appreciate childhood's charms until they're blown away. You can contemplate these bygone joys in some places more than others, and the Route 19 Inn in Maggie Valley is one such place. To reach this newly owned and inventively renovated motor lodge, from 1948 until 2018, it was the Rocky Waters Motel. I head west to Maggie Valley on Route 19 with Lake Junaluska on my right. From here to Cherokee, some 25 miles away, is North Carolina's version of Route 66. Since its beginning in 1927, Route 19 has eluded homogenization. Almost every establishment along the way is unique and old, from gift shops like the Rock Shop and Gem Mine to museums such as Wheels Through Time to attractions like the Stompin' Ground Dance Hall. Just as I reach the western edge of Maggie Valley, I'm greeted by a large sign topped with the Route 19 shield. Towering some 30 feet high, in glows across charmingly cartoonish mountain peaks. White neon lights announced vacancy. The brightness jolts me from the Smokies to the 1950s Las Vegas, and a more cultured and encompassing nostalgia arrives, not for reveries, fairylands, but for groovier moods of history. Just past the sign, I turn right and cross a bridge over a brisk creek, the Jonathan I found out later, and I remain in Retroland. There is a low-to-the-ground L-shaped building made of white concrete and divided into rooms with colorful doors and elegant rectangular windows. In front of the motel's office, an old-fashioned fuel pump and a vintage car, a 51 Kaiser, catch my eye. Nearby are the classic motor lodge amenities, a swimming pool and a playground, charcoal grills and picnic tables, shuffleboard, and fire pits around which, most evenings, guests sit and recount their adventures. I check in, open my door, and suddenly Elvis on his first tour, driving from gig to big gig, instruments jammed in his trunk, falling exhausted into rooms like this. Simple and spacious, with wood furniture and colorful ceramic tiles in the bathroom. Plus a back patio by a creek, in this case, the Phi. But it's not really a celebrity with whom I feel most connected as I settle into my patio chair and relish the rush of the Phi. It's my own dad, who died 3 years back. He grew up an hour away in Marion and would have been 14 in 1954, the year of Elvis's first hit. And though his parents were too poor to afford to stay in a motel, he was restless for America's motorways, which he traversed, like many of his time, with his thumb. In 1955, he hitchhiked to Asheville to see the king himself. My dad was born too late to fight in the Second World War, but his passion for rambling corresponded to the spirit of his age. When American men just returned from overseas, they could not sit still. With disposable income from a booming economy and automobiles improved by wartime technologies, they loaded up their families and hit the road. Highways were built to accommodate families' wanderlust, and motor lodges like this one arose for their rests. As much as nostalgia, family, and a theme of the Route 19 Inn, I discover this the next morning when I speak to Eric and Angela Frisbee, the inn's managers. I ask what the word retro means to them. After some thought, Eric, who's from Marion, like my dad, says that to him, the word signifies less a style and more of an experience. He remembers how on Saturday mornings his parents crowded the family into the car, headed to the grocery store to buy bread, lunch meats, chips, cookies, and pop, and then drove into nature, pulled off the road, and had a picnic. In fact, the very concept of the Route 19 Inn is steeped in family. Matt Ferguson, one of the owners, was drawn to Maggie Valley because his father-in-law had lived there for more than 30 years. A former marketing executive for Disney, Matt saw in the town a real version of Radiator Springs, the fictional Route 66 town in the film Cars. He imagined the property like a Disney man might, as a symbol of the ideal road trip. The excitement of the new, freshly renovated rooms, contemporary art, married to the comfort of the old, vintage design, artifacts from the 50s. My visit to the inn reminds me of something else about my family's trips to the mountains, something beside phantasms. There, my dad, normally serious and strict, cut the fool in the altitude, maybe a tad lightheaded. He did impersonations, Elvis, of course, and Bugs Bunny, performed magic tricks, it looked like he pulled his thumb right off, and created silly walks, though he'd surely never seen Monty Python. He also told stories, ones he'd made up, like how Little Joe and Hoss from Bonanza invented the football by blowing up a pig's bladder. His tales felt true to me. That's one of the gifts of the road. Away from the rules of the house, the difference between truth and make-believe can blur. Here, though, is the most authentic nostalgia, recalling those moments that formed the you that you became. Come spring, I'm going to drive my 7-year-old stepson to Maggie Valley. We'll stay at the Route 19 Inn. We'll play in the Fi, and I'll do my imitation of Templeton the Rat from Charlotte's Web. He will ask me to do it again. And again, and with the Smokies still high above, I will. Says Eric Wilson is the Thomas H. Pritchard Professor of English at Wake Forest University, where he teaches British and American Romanticism, creative nonfiction, film and literature, and cultural studies. At Route 19 Inn, it's on Succo Road in Maggie Valley, way out there before you get to Cherokee. Route19Inn.com. Here's an ad for Mumford Restoration, specializing in the period-correct restoration of family heirlooms, fine furniture, and antiques, family-owned, serving North Carolina families for 40 years. MumfordRestoration.com. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments, questions, please call the studios, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.